Friday break from the news. I recently stumbled across a website where people were debating, seriously, whether pianist Keith Jarrett was God. The Los Angeles Times calls Keith's trio with drummer Jack DeJohnette and bassist Gary Peacock, very simply, jazz at its finest. Best in the world, says the International Herald Tribune. No, it's the best in the 21st century, that from Bloomberg News. Well, now comes a reminder of what all the fuss is about. Keith Jarrett, Jack DeJohnette, and Gary Peacock playing the jazz standard When You Wish Upon a Star on a recently released 2-DVD set of the trio performing in Tokyo in the mid-80s. It's part of a 25th anniversary celebration that also includes a short tour and Setting Standards, a boxed set of the three CDs that launched the so-called Standards Project. The trio's, at the time, controversial idea to interpret the Great American Songbook. Keith Jarrett joins us from his home in New Jersey with more on that time that produced that music. Keith, welcome.
Thank you.
On the DVD, fans can see the player's techniques. We watch your hands, your foot on the pedal, and your face. You're smiling a lot. What are your memories of these sessions?
My memory of the visual things is quite limited because watching myself is a little different than other people watching me.
What's it like for you?
Sometimes it's great, but sometimes, you know, I have to look away because I might look like I'm into something, but the part of me that is the critic says to myself on the screen, how can you mean that? You can't be getting off on that. That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, and we should, you know, for the uninitiated, we should, you know, let people know that you're very, there's a physicality when you play. I want to listen, for instance, when Jack DeJohnette and Gary Peacock first join you on Stella by Starlight, and your face reads pure joy. We'll listen to that. Now that might be easier for you to watch, but there are times when you seem to be tortured. What is going on?
Well, it isn't torture, but it is, let's say you're getting information, you're getting how that information is going to be used, you're getting the dynamics, you're trying to do all this on the spur of the moment. That expression has to do with either triumphing over that situation or wishing I could have pushed it a little further. But it interestingly, when I started playing with Blakey, Art Blakey, I hadn't played with any major band up until that moment, and we played in a place where the piano was so stiff. And since I hadn't played seriously for a long time, a lot of the reviewers were, you know, just amazed at the music, and they said, Keith is like, he's so into it. He has this expression of ecstatic something or other. I don't remember what they said. And the truth was, my fingers were bleeding under my fingernails, and I was being tortured at that moment. So,
I'm sorry.
You never know, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Talking about the trio, we know you'd all known each other. You'd played with Jack DeJohnette, with Miles Davis, and elsewhere. But they both grew up as pianists. How did that add to the trio sound?
That's one of the best questions you could ask.
Right.
I began as a drummer, playing on tabletops in my kitchen, and I ended up with a drum set pretty early in my teens and was sort of trying to be the drummer in that band, especially when they weren't filling up spaces with their own playing. So something with a lot of space in it. And Jack and I, when we were with Charles Lloyd, we often would go to jam sessions after the gig, and people would say, why don't you play? So we would go up on the stage and go to the wrong instruments. I mean, the ones people didn't expect us to go to. And that's where we would be. The short answer is, that's one of the reasons this trio has lasted this long. We understand the music inside out from all each other's perspectives as someone knowledgeable with more than one of the three instruments. And because of that, I don't have to say anything to them, because if they were the pianist, they would know what they would require of the bass player, for example. So that kind of flexibility is almost unheard of in, you know, a major group, I think.
Well, you know, I want to ask, too, because you mentioned banging on the table as a kid, but you were also a child prodigy. You played classical piano.
Yeah.
And you had an incendiary solo career. I'm wondering, what else did the trio give you? Because, you know, people were, you know, very just, you know, upset. You have said that there was something that happened in the trio work that helped you escape something that was happening in the solo work. I'm reading that you felt that listeners increasingly wanted to see a virtuoso genius immolate himself, that there was this expectation of you as a soloist, and working with the trio and working on standards gave you some respite from that.
Oh, yes. I keep them away from each other because the techniques that I need to use in each of those situations are completely different. Like what your left hand does, what your right hand does, all what your mind does, all that stuff. But In a way, it was a perfect way to balance the equation for me. I wouldn't call it immolation anymore, if that's what I actually said, but I would say that I now can pick and choose times in my life when solo makes sense to me. People were expecting actually more of the same, and when people start expecting more of the same, that's time for someone who improvises to stop for a while.
I read too that they were increasingly expecting that the more of the same would be sort of a magic act.
Did I say magic act?
No, I just did.
Okay, I wouldn't have put it that way, but let's just use your statement for a minute.
Okay.
I expect the magic act, and as a result, I have to know how to know when to do it and when not to. In other words, I can't be overconfident and on tour doing solo, or I'll get used to some kind of habit pattern that's against my better judgment. So I'm the one with the greatest expectations. The audience is there because of my expectations being that great.
But you can't do it. I'd imagine it's very hard to do it every night.
Oh, you can't. You cannot play from zero for 2 hours healthily very often. That's true.
Welcome back. That's God Bless the Child from Setting Standards, the box set that's part of a celebration of Keith Jarrett's Standards Trio, Jarrett on piano, Jack DeJohnette drums, and bassist Gary Peacock. For more on the tour and CDs and the songs we're playing, go to hear-now.org. But back to Keith Jarrett. And Keith, it's hard to imagine now when everyone, including Rod Stewart, is singing jazz standards. But in 1983, standards were passé, so why did you decide to do them?
Because it was a forgotten language. and we had first dibs. It was a radical thought. In fact, it was so radical, Gary couldn't believe I was asking him to do this. And Gary said, I had to investigate your work up to that time to see whether I trusted you that we were doing something important. And I had to have dinner with them and tell them the reasons I had for this, which was to not possess the music, not write clever new pieces that they don't last for any length of time. They're just like little niblets that jazzers seem to come up with, and then they start improvising. I wanted something that was holistic. Like, say, some group gets a contract if they have their own music. This trio was supposed to actually completely bypass that trend and force the listener to listen to how we're playing the music, which to me is essentially what jazz is about. How do you play? It's not what you're playing. But on the other hand, the best era in American melody writing and songwriting has got to be the era we're dealing with. And I said to the guys, you know, we've all been sidemen and we've all been leaders up to this point. What if we all become sidemen? Remember how privileged it is to be a sideman. And we don't rehearse, so nobody tells anybody else. I don't tell Gary how to play. I don't tell Jack whether to use sticks or brushes. And the three of us have had such an enormous batch of musical experience that we're ready for anything when we play.
Let's listen to When I Fall in Love, Victor Young and Edward Heyman's classic, from Keith Jarrett, Jack DeJohnette, and Gary Peacock. Keith, did you say you don't rehearse?
Don't rehearse.
Do you also not really even see each other that much to keep
it? We don't see each other between gigs.
At all?
No, not really.
Is that to keep it fresh?
No, it's just trust. Like, here's how it goes. This is hard for musicians, even other musicians, to believe. We just show up. That's the whole game plan. Show up, be undrugged, be healthy, be ready to play. I said to the two guys, this is the deal. We already know this material, and that's what's so radical about this idea. People will think we're doing something similar, and if we come out with a zillion albums, as long as we keep the same principles, it'll never be the same.
Well, on the other hand, you have composed some of the most beautiful music. A couple of your cuts are on the DVD, Rider, for one, on the two DVD collection. Mm-hmm. Keith Jarrett, when I asked people what I should ask you to a person, they said, oh, why doesn't he compose anymore? We want to hear music like we heard during the European Quartet with Jan Garbarek or the American Quartet with Dewey Redman. I personally, just the other day, listened to the Köln concert.
Yeah.
And I can still weep. Why did you stop composing, and might we see a return to that?
Wow, those are lots of questions all rolled up in one. Because once I made a record for CBS, then I was dropped 2 weeks later. The title is Expectations. The meaning of that title was always misconstrued to mean, here's an artist with great, that maybe should, you think that he has great expectations for the future or something like that. I don't know, some kind of version of that. But my meaning of it was, don't have them. Expectations is what I don't think. In other words, if you think of the Köln concert and whatever albums you might have mentioned, I forget some of them.
The quartet
stuff,
work.
Stuff with Jan and the stuff with the American Quartet. All of that came about because nobody asked for it.
I'm sorry I asked.
No. I know there are people that want A or B or C, but if I'm going to have my integrity intact, then I'm never going to listen to that. I'm going to listen to what my heart is telling me to do. once they start requesting it, it becomes like an electricity, a voltage surge of that one desire. And I'd rather erase that desire completely so that they're again totally open to something brand new, like at the time the Colm concert would have been, than follow their request because I'm an entertainer, which I'm not. So I think you know what I'm saying.
I don't know what you're talking about because I never ask for anything.
Oh, okay.
In the hope that I don't break any electric surge here.
Well, that's not easy to explain that stuff. Now, people would be requesting, you know, of Tony Bennett that he sings a certain encore or something. If we do an encore over and over again, it's because we still didn't get everything from that song. And we still know there's more there.
Keith Jarrett, thank you so much for taking some time to speak to us.
Thank you, Robin. we could talk a long time.
Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama said today from Hawaii that his gravely ill grandmother may not live to see Election Day. Yesterday, we spoke of Obama's close relationship with his white grandmother in our conversation about mixed race in America. Well, today, a very different kind of race relations regarding John McCain. McCain's great-great-grandfather owned slaves in Mississippi before the Civil War. When those slaves were freed, two adopted the McCain surname and continued living on the land. Senator John McCain stayed at the old family plantation as a child, but grew to adulthood, largely unaware of his family's ties to slavery. So what is the family connection? Well, Douglas Blackman of the Wall Street Journal wrote about the two McCains recently. He's also author of the book Slavery by Another Name, The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. You might remember when we spoke to him about that book. And he joins us again today from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Doug, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
And you write that the McCains, at least in the early 20th century, were known among African Americans for relatively equitable treatment of their workers and tenants. And this was, of course, after slavery, but it might speak to what they were like as slave owners as well.
The white McCains had a good reputation, especially relative to the horrifying treatment that African-American laborers received from the great majority of large white landowners in Mississippi and across the South. And that is an important point. One also shouldn't make too much of it, because all of that happened inside an incredibly abusive system of mistreatment of African-Americans in that era.
They share a name and a history, but do the two McCains share blood?
The oral history of the black McCains is very specific. There's a very specific oral history of who was the half-brother of Senator McCain's great-grandfather. Of course, there's no way to know, to verify what exactly is the case without genetic testing or something like that. And some would argue it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. And the white McCains say that if that's the case, they aren't aware of it. But among black McCains, the oral history is very specific in that regard.
Right. There's other aspects of the oral history, and you captured it. You spoke to some of the slaves' descendants, the black McCains. This is from the video you shot for your story in the journal. This is Mary McCain Fluker.
My grandfather always told us that our slave name was Levenham. And your name now is McCain because my grandfather was purchased as a slave.
So, Doug, how have the two McCain families interacted in modern times?
The reconnection between the black and white McCains began a few years ago, because what had preceded that was that by about 1950, the early 1960s, the white McCains had largely abandoned Carroll County, Mississippi, this ancestral homeland, There is a cousin of Senator McCain who still owns the majority of the old Teoc plantation.
That's Bill McCain, right?
That's right. Bill McCain, a cousin of Senator McCain, still owns about 1,500 acres of the plantation, and it's farmed by people who rent the land from him. So it's still in production. But the McCains, the white McCains, had ceased to be particularly important people in Carroll County because they were gone. Meanwhile, the black McCains had emerged in this really extraordinary way as incredibly important leaders in this place in every generation subsequent to slavery, in fact. The son of the slave, Isom McCain, started the first school for African-American children in the county, or was at least deeply involved in the starting and running of that school in the 1880s and 1890s. His son was one of the first African-Americans in the county to acquire land and became the great advocate among African-Americans that they buy land and never sell out to whites, that if they ever sold their land, to sell it to other blacks. His son, the father of Mary McCain Fluker, who you heard in the audio a few seconds ago, he became the leader of the NAACP in this county. He worked with Stokely Carmichael with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. They housed civil rights workers in their home during Freedom Summer in 1964. Their church was burned after Stokely Carmichael spoke there. The children, including Mary, integrated the public schools, the all-white public schools in this county, and then all of them went on to finish college and have meaningful careers. And so this is an extraordinary family of tremendous triumph. They had very little to do, though, with the white McCains until a few years ago when the oldest child in this family, who had become the first black fire chief in the nearby town of Greenwood, was killed in an auto accident involving a drunken driver. And a cousin, a black cousin of the McCains, who knew the white McCain family, invited Bill McCain, this cousin of the senator, to come to the funeral. And he did. And he stood with the black McCains in the family section during the funeral. And that was the beginning of a reconnection between the families. And since then, about 24 white McCains have at various times attended family reunions organized by the black McCains, and a dialogue has begun.
Now, Senator John McCain hasn't attended those reunions. Has he said anything about the black McCains?
When I talked to the campaign about it, what they said was that he hasn't attended the reunion simply because of scheduling conflicts. What he has said about the black McCains, particularly when I raised the topic with the campaign about these extraordinary lives that the black McCains have led, his response was very, very praising of the black McCains. He spoke of them as a testament to what Americans can accomplish through perseverance and dedication to principle. And I think he must be sincere about that.
Yeah. You also spoke with Charles McCain, Jr. He's another descendant of the slaves owned by John McCain's great-grandfather. And he talked about what it means to him that other members of John McCain's family, members of the white McCain family, do attend their family reunions. Let's listen.
It means something. I wouldn't be afraid to say it means a lot. And be a particular, just a down-to-earth, just regular guy. And I really, you know, admire that in him, and I appreciate that. Because, you know, well, I try to be the same way. Just, you know, be what you are, be who you are, and that's it.
Bill McCain again, the white McCain cousin who has reached out to the black McCains. What do you make of all this, Doug Blackman?
Well, what it says most profoundly to me, and by the way, I grew up in a little town in Mississippi about 45 miles away from this place where the white McCains and the black McCains come from. I didn't know anything about it, but I know this world very well. What I found profound was, number one, just what an extraordinary story the black McCains really represent, the kind of heroes that they really were, like thousands of other people who have not been put in the history books, but who were absolutely the anchors of how America was saved from itself in the civil rights movement in the years since then. But it's also a story in its own complicated way about how the white McCains have also escaped the tortured legacy of slavery. Now, I won't say that the white McCains have figured it all out or completely come to grips with what it means that their position in life was so advanced and sustained by its base rooted in slavery. But nonetheless, that's a white family that has broken from the legacy of slavery and is trying to come to terms with it in some way. And for me, that's fairly profound.
Doug Blackman, Atlanta Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal, also author of the book Slavery by Another Name, The Reenslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. We highly recommend it. And now he's penned this story about the two McCain families, black and white. Doug Blackman, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, and don't forget, before we go today, Director Charlie Kaufman, you're listening to Here and Now. Well, it's all even at one apiece. The Tampa Bay Rays beat the Philadelphia Phillies 4-2 last night in St. Petersburg, Florida. The World Series now moves north to the city of brotherly love for Game 3 tomorrow night. Joining us to talk about the Fall Classic and the rest of the week in sports, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. I love when I get to talk like a sports person.
Yeah, it's great fun. I love that kind of talk.
And you know, speaking of talk, people always say that the TV executives wanted to have a Boston-Los Angeles World Series matchup to, you know, for higher ratings, but baseball fans are not complaining about what they're getting to see.
Real fans certainly aren't, because they're getting to see two teams that are sort of strangers to the postseason. Philadelphia hasn't won a World Series since 1980 and was in the series most recently in 93. And, of course, Tampa has always been in last place or next to last place some people must feel as if the newspaper's
right.
been turned upside down.
But now Tampa Bay, they're scrappy. Are they impressing you?
They are scrappy. They've impressed me with their poise, Robin. When you can go into the late innings of a close game and have one of your infielders kick a ball around, that usually is the signal for collapse. And I don't want to talk about particular collapses triggered by infielders kicking the ball around, because
yes.
that's a painful subject here
yes.
in Boston. But Tampa has held fast. They've played very well. They shake off the problems. They score runs on ground ball outs. They've done all kinds of things well.
Of course, but we don't ever count the Phillies out. And their manager, Charlie Manuel, called last night's performance one of the sloppiest games they played all season.
Well, the sloppiest thing that his players have done is fail to get hits with runners in scoring position. And that may be sloppy, and it may be testimony to the fact that Tampa has pretty good pitching staff.
And what do you think Philadelphia needs to do to get back on track?
They need to hit. Okay. It's a simple thing. Baseball's a simple game, as Johnny Pesky always says, but so hard to play.
That's right. Well, staying with baseball for just a second, and speaking of hitting, Manny Ramirez, formerly of the Red Sox, moved to the Dodgers. He of the dreadlocks and free spirit is now a free agent, reportedly asking the Dodgers for $20 million a year for 6 years
yes.
to keep him in what's now being called Mannywood.
Well, Manny did himself a great favor, first of all, by playing brilliantly through the part of the regular season he spent in Los Angeles and carrying the Dodgers into the postseason pretty much all by himself. They'd been mediocre at best without him. And then, of course, in the postseason, all he did was hit .520 with a whole bunch of home runs. So if the Dodgers don't at least make a heck of an effort to keep him, they're going to have some splaining to do to their fans in Los Angeles. Will they pay him $20 million a year for 6 years? That would take him to age 42. I kind of doubt it. I don't think any team is going to do that. But, you know, they're just at the starting point for these negotiations. We'll see what happens.
Football question for you. It looks like New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady's road to recovery from his season-ending knee surgery just got a little longer. His left knee, the one doctors operated on to reconstruct his ACL, is now infected. Now, we hear at best that could mean a months-long delay in rehab or recovery. At worst, well, people don't even want to think about that.
Well,
do
people don't like to think about infections after surgery, and they don't like to think about additional interventions after surgery to correct infections and clear them up. I don't think anybody knows how this is going to turn out. It's bad news, obviously, for Tom Brady and for the Patriots as well.
Well, and speaking of superstars with shaky knees, David Beckham was supposed to be the savior of soccer here in the U.S., you know, when the L.A. Galaxy signed him, lucrative deal 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I looked away, and now he's on his way to Italy.
Well,
what happened?
Loans in the world of soccer, pro soccer, are not unusual. Teams frequently loan players to other teams for some period of time. Beckham is going to be playing in Milan now that the Major League Soccer season is over for his team, because the Galaxy didn't make the playoffs. Beckham's reason for doing this is because the coach of England's national team has said that he will only consider players who are game ready, who have been playing,
when he puts the next national team roster together. Beckham really wants to play for England a few more times because he wants to break the record for number of caps playing for England's national team. So caps is just what you get when you play for the national team each time. So maybe this will be temporary. Maybe he'll be back in Los Angeles. We just have to hope he doesn't like Italian cooking so much that he decides to work out a deal and stay in Milan.
Bill says, please. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports program, Only a Game. Catch it on the weekend. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And coming up, screenwriter and now director Charlie Kaufman, in a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. Screenwriter Charlie Kaufman is known for his bizarre, layered stories that unearth and illuminate the human condition. His angst-ridden characters struggle with relationships with themselves and with their creative process. In his 2002 film adaptation, Kaufman even inserted himself into the story. Actor Nicolas Cage plays a neurotic screenwriter named Charlie Kaufman.
I'm hungry. I should get coffee. Coffee would help me think. But I should write something first, then reward myself with coffee. Coffee and a muffin. Okay, so I need to establish the themes. Maybe banana nut. That's a good muffin.
Well, now, the real Charlie Kaufman has a new movie, Synecdoche, New York. He wrote and directed it and is now touring to promote it. Here now is Andrea Shea met up with Kaufman when he visited Boston.
Charlie Kaufman sits in a fancy boutique hotel conference room. He's 50, has lots of curly hair, wears jeans, and seems uncomfortable in the she-she setting. His new film, the difficult-to-pronounce Synecdoche, New York, screened about 18 hours ago at a theater in Cambridge's Harvard Square. The house was packed with young, chatty groupies. Even so, Kaufman admits the whole touring the world to push his film scenario is depressing.
I don't watch the movie because I've seen it so many times, so I go and I wander in the college town, Harvard Square, and I just feel so ancient and invisible, and I'm wandering these streets, and everyone seems so young and in love and happy and laughing, and so I just get miserable.
Kaufman actually sounds like some of his characters, doesn't he? We'll get to that, but first, the title. A synecdoche is a figure of speech with multiple meanings, but it's basically a part representing a whole, which says something about what audiences can expect from Kaufman's hard-to-explain film. Part of Kaufman can be seen in Synecdoche's lead character, played by actor Philip Seymour Hoffman.
His name is Caden Cotard, and he is a theater director in Schenectady, New York. He's doing regional theater there.
Kaufman himself has and still directs plays.
He's having health issues and fear of dying issues.
Caden develops pustules on his skin only he can see, also a spastic leg, which he shows to a doctor.
And this started just today. Never happened before.
His wife leaves him with their daughter.
The wife is played by actress Catherine Kinnear.
I don't know what I'm doing. We're just spending a little time apart.
He sort of spends the rest of the movie trying to either get them back or prove to her that he's worth coming back to. And in doing this, he mounts a very, very large theater piece.
Caden casts actors to play the people in his life as it happens, including his own actor double.
I've been following you for 20 years. So I knew about this audition because I follow you. And I learned everything about you by following you. So hire me, and you'll see who you truly are.
It's all very meta and layered as it
gets larger and larger until he's actually built a full-size replica of New York City in a warehouse in New York, trying to get close to the truth in his art.
Caden?
What?
When are we going to get an audience in here? It's been 17 years.
Whoa, pretty weird indeed. Kaufman says Synecdoche is his attempt to get close to the truth in his own art. It's a personal meditation on the stuff of life he finds scary or intriguing. Even Caden Cotard's name and state of being are based on a rare syndrome.
I like syndromes, and I like psychotic syndromes. And so Cotard syndrome is a condition where the person who has it thinks that they're already dead.
Or in Caden's case, always on the cusp.
I will be dying, and so will you, and so will everyone here. And that's what I want to explore. We're all hurtling towards death.
So I was thinking about dying, and I was thinking about illness, and I was thinking about aging, and I was thinking about family, and, you know, and everything that sort of surrounds those very, I think, universal concerns for me. And then I put it in this form, and that's the script.
Kaufman's script is surreal and elliptical. Bodily functions and fluids ooze through the movie. One character lives in a house that's continually on fire. She and everyone has an actor double, which is a pretty hilarious concept to consider. Kaufman paints an alternating world that is more dream than reality, for a reason.
Because there is this kind of thing that happens in dreams where you can't verbalize it, and yet it shakes you, you know, to the core of your existence when you wake up and think about it.
Daddy doesn't live with us anymore, baby. He had to go find himself.
Hey, you had his moment.
Yeah.
They still feel a little tight in the toe. But maybe...
Have an argument. You're having an argument. Have it.
It's Chinese boxes, it's Russian dolls, it's plots within plots, wheels within wheels, and it's what Charlie Kaufman does best.
That's Ty Burr. He reviews film for the Boston Globe.
Within scenes, months will pass between cuts. Suddenly you'll realize you've gone like 5 years and that, you know, one character has grown from a child into a woman. Actually, the movie reminded me more of anything else, of a Kurt Vonnegut novel, like one of those classic late 60s Kurt Vonnegut novels where time just gets thrown in the Cuisinart and the hero just sort of rides it as best he can.
And for his new movie, Kaufman is riding a brand new horse. He wrote Being John Malkovich, Adaptation, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, but Synecdoche is Kaufman's directing debut. Directing, of course, is a big job involving the management of real time, real actors, and real money. It was tough, Kaufman admits, to shoot at a breakneck pace over 45 days. As a writer, he says he doesn't believe characters have arcs or need to change over the course of a film, but he says directing for the first time changed him.
I mean, it changed me in the sense that I did it. I directed a movie. It's like when I finished my first screenplay, it sort of didn't matter to me that much whether it was good or not. It was just that I had written 110 pages of something, you know, which seemed insurmountable to me before. And that made the next screenplay easier. I knew I could write another screenplay after I did that one. So I feel like I can direct a movie now.
For film critic Ty Burr, Synecdoche represents a solid first effort.
Not everything in Synecdoche, New York works. And this is not a movie that is going to make gazillions of dollars at the box office. And I don't think anybody involved expects it to. I think Charlie Kaufman just wants to have it be successful enough that he can continue to make movies. And, you know, God bless him. He should. Nobody out there is sort of pushing that envelope the way that he is.
Kaufman says he's very interested in making more movies, and so he hopes Synecdoche will make money at the box office. But he recognizes his film isn't for everyone. In the end, though, Kaufman just wants audiences to connect to his work on an emotional level, like any good work of art. And so he refuses to explain what Synecdoche is about.
It's like when I go to a museum and I look at a painting, no one's telling me what the painting is or what it's about. I have my experience with it. And if it's something that is moving to me, it's moving to me personally in ways that may be even inexplicable.
For today, though, Kaufman might have done well to have cast his own actor double. He looks unsettled as the press person gives us the time's up signal, and he snaps back to the reality of selling his film. Kaufman looks around the hotel conference room and explains how his itinerary is affecting him.
This is hard for me. I'm traveling a lot, and I'm feeling kind of lonely and isolated, and I'm traveling for an entire month. And, you know, and talking about the movie and talking about myself, it's not... Sometimes it just feels stupid and embarrassing, and then I go and sit in my hotel room, and the potato chips are stale. So I don't know.
Well, who does?
Here and Now's Andrea Shea. Charlie Kaufman's new film, Synecdoche, New York, opens today in selected cities. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a wonderful weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.